This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. Maybe your mornings sound like this. You wake up to your alarm ringing, you turn it off, and bring your phone back to bed with you. You scroll through email and social media, squinting through one eye to see what you've got to get done and what's happening in the news. When you finally get up and start getting ready, maybe you have some music going. Or your favorite TV channel.
And we continue to follow that breaking news in South Charlotte.
Many of us are voracious consumers of information. And we're always looking for new ways to take in even more.
Alexa, what's the weather today?
In Charlotte, North Carolina, it's 63 degrees with mostly sunny skies.
But even as we savor good news about the weather or the stock market or weekend plans, we're also regularly confronted by stuff that's unpleasant.
To listen to your unread voicemails, press 1.
Unpleasant information creates a paradox for the brain. This kind of information is often very important.
First message.
This is the principal calling from your son's school. Please contact us so we can arrange a time to discuss your son's behavior.
But this kind of information also produces psychic pain, and one of the oldest rules in the brain is to avoid things that are painful.
Second message.
This is the doctor's office. Your test results have come in. Please call us back immediately.
The tension between what we rationally know to be important and what we emotionally experience as painful is the subject of our episode today.
Third message.
Hey, just call me back as soon as you get this. I saw your wife kissing somebody. Sorry. Just give me a call.
It's about why we sometimes...
Message deleted.
Message deleted. Message deleted.
Shut it all out. Why we look away and the consequences of doing so, this week on Hidden Brain. There's an old theory in economics about information. It goes like this. You should always be willing to hear information about your finances or your health. For example,
hey, Antonio, help yourself to anything in the fridge, but heads up, sniff the milk first. I think it's getting close to the expiration date.
Maybe this information is useful. Maybe it's not.
Oh, I'm fine. I'm actually lactose intolerant.
No matter how you feel about the information, there's one thing you should never do.
A person should never avoid information because information can never hurt a decision.
This is Josh Tassoff.
I'm an assistant professor of economics at Claremont Graduate University.
Josh says less is never more when it comes to information. We always should want to know if our 401k is about to take a nosedive or if we're at risk of contracting a disease. But here's the thing. Humans aren't always rational. And when it comes to information...
Information can be anxiety-provoking. It could be depressing.
What do we do when something makes us sad or depressed? We turn away from it. When the thing that's depressing is information, we say, I don't want to hear about it. Social scientists call this behavior information aversion. More commonly, it's called the ostrich effect. The term comes not from birds, but investors.
So when the stock market goes down, people check their portfolio less frequently than when the stock market is going up.
And why would that be?
Well, the interpretation is that the information causes sort of immediate pain just from hearing it, right? People are anticipating sort of their future losses. Of course, they don't actually have any losses yet, but they're anticipating those future losses, and that causes an emotional pain obtaining that information.
Information aversion is one of many, many domains where human behavior seems to deviate from the models of economists. Instead of doing the rational thing, learning as much as possible about something, many of us do the opposite. We stick our heads in the sand. And this is true for more than just financial information. A while back, we asked Hidden Brain listeners to call in and tell us about their news consumption.
Hi, Annie here.
Hello, my name is Nancy Walter.
Hi, Shaka, this is Jason Flakes.
Jason, Nancy, and Annie are all addicted to the news.
My husband and I are news junkies.
I'm listening to the news every day.
Checking it every few hours.
Or at least, they were addicted to the news until Donald Trump caught them by surprise and won the 2016 presidential election.
I hadn't anticipated Donald Trump winning. So I went on a complete news blackout.
It's because of the frustration that I was feeling.
and actually had a lot of anxiety because of it. I have dramatically changed the way I read the news following the election.
These listeners had their fingers on the pulse of political news before the election, when Hillary Clinton appeared to be poised for victory. But in the days and weeks after Trump's surprising win, Jason, Nancy, and Annie began to avoid the news. It was like the investors who stare lovingly at their portfolios when the stock market's on the rise, but avoid looking whenever the market dips. Headlines about the Trump administration stressed these listeners out. It caused them pain, and that's a key marker of information aversion. Now, there are times when people avoid information when it's simply too much to digest. Let's say you're studying for a big test, and after hours and hours of reading, you close your textbooks and take a break. This is information overload. You're burnt out from taking in so much stuff. With information aversion, the driver isn't that there's too much information, it's that the information is unpleasant. If you were to tell these people about pleasant things, they'd be glad to listen all day.
People want information, want more information about happier future experiences than less happy future experiences.
Josh wanted to see how much people prefer happy information to unpleasant information. He wanted to test that age-old theory. You should always be willing to hear information about your finances or your health. So he teamed up with a colleague.
I'm Ananda Ganguly. I'm at Claremont McKenna College.
And they asked participants to come in and sit at a desk for 20 minutes.
And posted in at their cubicle in front of them were two envelopes, one labeled big and one labeled small.
They told the volunteers that there was a 10% chance the envelopes were filled with cash.
But if the big envelope contains money, it contains $100. If the small envelope contains money, it contains $10.
The volunteers would get to open the envelopes at the end of 20 minutes and pocket the contents. Now, if 20 minutes was too long to wait, Josh and Ananda said the volunteers could pay money to open one of the envelopes immediately.
83.4% paid money to affect the timing.
Did you actually physically observe the volunteers? Did you notice anything as they were dealing with this? Could you actually see the dilemma on their faces?
Yeah, they were in the computer. They were in a computer lab and doing this. And absolutely, I mean, it was almost like in a casino. They would start tearing the envelopes open, and immediately, I'm very excited about it. And F words would fly.
And would F words fly once they'd opened the envelopes or before?
After they opened the envelopes, it's the disappointment or the surprise.
Here's the trick in the experiment. Remember that there were two envelopes, one big, one small. Big envelopes carry the potential of a big sum of money. Small envelopes carry the potential of a small sum of money. You can guess which ones the volunteers wanted to open.
What we find is that people are twice as likely to open up the big envelope over the small envelope. The interpretation is that winning $100 is a lot more happy and a lot more exciting than winning $10. And so people's demand for that information, even though it's completely useless in their decision-making, is much higher.
I'm not sure I fully followed that. Walk me through that again.
Well, the information here is completely useless for making any decisions. So no matter what, they're going to get this money or not get the money, right? They're just going to sit there for 20 minutes. And so receiving this information, unlike, other decisions in our life, you could think in our daily life, if you're going to get a raise or anything like this, that information can be very useful because it'll help you improve your purchase decisions right now in the present. But here, they're basically stuck sitting in the lab in a seat. And so receiving this information 20 minutes earlier is completely useless. They can't use it to improve any decisions in that short interim period.
Even if receiving the information earlier was useless, lots of volunteers were perfectly willing to pay to find out what was inside the envelope sooner. The bigger the potential good news, the more likely volunteers were to pay. The study showed that people are hungry for information when information is pleasant. Now, there's one important detail we haven't told you yet. The amount the volunteers had to pay wasn't very much, just 50 cents to open an envelope. Since the big envelope could hold as much as $100, you might say that paying 50 cents was a trivial cost.
We wanted to look at something that had greater real-world stakes.
We know people want pleasant information, but are they willing to pay to avoid unpleasant news, like information about a disease? Josh and Ananda decided to find out. They thought about the health concerns you might see on a college campus.
The sample that we have access to are college undergrads, right? And so we could do something like a cancer test, but I don't think college undergrads are terribly concerned about that. I think what college undergrads tend to be typically concerned about is STDs.
STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. One of the most stigmatized and common diseases on college campuses is herpes. It's caused by the herpes simplex virus, or HSV.
We chose HSV because the prevalence, the rate of prevalence of HSV in this population is rather high. I mean, rough numbers are around 50%. Chances are every other person has it, so they would have it. And then the other attractive thing about HSV for us is it had this kind of two levels, kind of parallel $10 and $100 thing.
There's herpes simplex virus 1 and herpes simplex virus 2. Herpes simplex virus 1 is typically associated with cold sores, and herpes simplex virus 2 is typically associated with genital herpes.
HSV 1, it's the oral herpes, is less considered to be less severe or less stigmatic or whatever in the population.
Ananda and Josh asked college students to come back to their lab. This time, volunteers were asked to sit through a webinar about herpes.
We actually give them photographs of sores on the lips and photographs of sores on male and female genitalia with a discussion of HSV 1 and HSV 2.
And these pictures were graphic?
These pictures were very graphic. In fact, we don't know that we'll want to put it in the paper. They were completely clinical graphic.
Since Josh and Ananda knew that some people avoid getting tested for herpes because they don't want to deal with a blood test, volunteers were told they had to have their blood drawn in order to stay in the study. The researchers told volunteers they could have the blood tested for free for both kinds of herpes. Volunteers were assured confidentiality.
They were allowed to call into the lab with their initials and four randomly selected numbers of their own choice. Even the doctor would not know who they were.
So, to recap, students were given graphic information about two forms of herpes. The researchers then proceeded to eliminate all the usual reasons someone might not want to get tested for the sexually transmitted disease. It was mandatory for the volunteers to get their blood drawn, the test was free, and the results would be obtained confidentially. Would volunteers elect to find out if they had herpes, or would they choose to bury their heads in the sand? To test for information aversion, the researchers told the volunteers that they would have to pay $10 to not get their blood tested. A significant number of volunteers elected to pay this money. And just as the researchers had expected, volunteers were more likely to pay money to avoid getting highly unpleasant information about genital herpes than the less unpleasant information about oral herpes.
Tell me about those people. So they just sat, did that happen in front of them, or how did that happen?
So the phlebotomist drew the blood, and we said, okay, so this was your choice. You had chosen not to be tested, so now this blood would be discarded. Would you please drop it down the sink and wash it out?
And they did.
They did. They would drop the tube into the sink and turn on the faucet, and it would go.
I mean, at some level, that has to be a little bit disturbing, right? The idea that you're drawing blood and throwing it down the sink?
Yes, absolutely. And that's kind of the point here, though. So they are going to have the blood drawn. So you'd rather pay money, waste that blood, than know what your test results were.
Did any of the students give you verbal feedback about what happened and their impressions of it? Did any of them explain why they declined to be tested? I mean, they obviously must have thought about what the implications were as they made the choice.
Oh, yeah. So we actually asked them, what was your motivation? 85.7%, the most common explanation was because, quote, it will cause me unnecessary stress or anxiety if I test positive.
It's worth pointing out that there isn't a cure for HSV, and public health guidelines do not call for everyone to get tested unless they have symptoms. Still, students who rejected the test on principle ought to have been equally likely to reject both the test for oral herpes and the test for genital herpes. The fact that many more rejected the genital herpes test suggests information aversion was at work. approximately 20% of the students were willing to pay cold, hard cash to avoid finding out that they had genital herpes. Another thing the researchers found, students who were in a good mood were more likely to avoid information than those in a bad mood. This may seem surprising, but it actually makes complete sense. When you're in a good mood, do you really want to ruin how you feel by discovering you have herpes?
It's like an ignorance is bliss result.
Think for a moment about the implications of information aversion. So many health and well-being messages are premised on the idea that people will act rationally when it comes to preserving their health. What if that isn't true for a sizable number of people?
I think that we should consider whether scare tactics in advertising and things like that, I mean, whether that is a good technique to encourage people to get tested or not is questionable.
When we come back, we're going to leave the lab and see how information aversion plays out in the real world. Stay with us. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and you're listening to Hidden Brain from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Little Passports, a monthly subscription service for kids. Each package includes games, souvenirs, and activities from a new country designed to spark curiosity in cultures around the globe. At littlepassports.com/radio. From the National Endowment for the Arts, the federal agency that supports the arts and creativity in communities across the nation. More information is available at arts.gov. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. There's no question that fear is an effective way to change how people behave. When a parent tells a kid to fall in line or risk losing iPad privileges for a week, or when a boss tells an employee to come into work on time or risk getting fired, these often produce the desired effect. We use scare tactics in public service announcements all the time, like in this road safety commercial from Thailand, where a speeding car runs into a group of pedestrians, or this anti-smoking advertisement from Poland, where a lit cigarette is transformed into a candle at the base of a tombstone. In Josh and Ananda's study, the majority of volunteers chose to get tested after being exposed to graphic images of herpes. This makes sense, says University of Illinois psychology professor Dolores Albarracin.
If you induce a significant level of fear, you're going to get a comparable reaction on the behavioral side.
Dolores and a team of researchers analyzed 250 studies done about the effectiveness of fear in transforming behavior. While the research shows fear indeed is effective, Dolores says it has limitations.
It does work better for one-time behavior. So getting vaccinated, if I have a threat and there is an effective vaccine right after and I just go in and get it one time, that's easy to do. The behavior is done right after you experience the emotion. Emotions are not that long-lasting, so it's going to have an effect. But if it comes down to following the right diet, we all know how difficult that is. And whatever fear you might experience at one point is gone the next day.
This is the crux of the issue. If you want someone to do something one time, frightening them into doing it could be very effective. But if you want them to do something regularly and over a long period of time, fear might not be effective. In fact, some research suggests it could be counterproductive. Let me just have you start, if you don't mind, by just introducing yourself and tell me your name.
Sure. My name is Ritesh Banerjee. I'm an economist.
A few years ago, Ritesh and his colleague, Giulio Zanella, began looking at data about 3,000 American women who all worked at a large company. All the women were between the ages of 50 and 64, and they were all covered by an insurance plan that provided a free mammogram every year.
Which is perceived to be an important tool in the fight against breast cancer.
This company made a real push to help women get screened for breast cancer. It would automatically schedule mammograms for staffers and then remind women about upcoming appointments. Screenings were conducted right at the company, so they were easy to get to, and the wait times were minimal. In other words, many of the barriers that keep women from getting tested were absent at this company. Ritesh wanted to find out how the decisions of women to get screened for breast cancer were shaped by information aversion. He obtained detailed information from the company about employees, including their health status and where they physically sat in relation to one another. He discovered that when one staffer was diagnosed with breast cancer, this dramatically changed the behavior of other women who worked in her vicinity.
We find that on average, when a woman is diagnosed with breast cancer, her co-workers, her immediate co-workers, female co-workers, reduce their propensity to have a breast screening in the year in which the diagnosis takes place. And this impact is persistent for at least 2 more years after the diagnosis for that woman. Women in the closest proximity to the woman who was diagnosed with breast cancer learn of this information. Their willingness to screen falls the most.
Ritesh found that the severity of the disease was key. Women who had a coworker diagnosed with early-stage breast cancer were less likely to skip their annual screenings. But if a woman had a more aggressive case of breast cancer, her colleagues were the ones who were more likely to skip the screenings.
So it appears in our data that in groups where the stage of the cancer is late stage, so not an earlier stage of cancer, the avoidance behavior that we're observing is stronger.
Women who knew a coworker who was dying from breast cancer were the most likely to skip their mammograms. Seeing a colleague suffer may have frightened these women from obtaining information about their own health. Not long ago, I was playing squash with a friend on a weekend. I was trying to change directions quickly when my ankle gave out from under me. I felt a sharp pain and collapsed. In a matter of moments, my ankle started to swell up. It was like watching a balloon inflate. I got some ice on the ankle right away, but when the pain and swelling didn't subside and I found I could put no weight on the ankle, I decided I had to go to the emergency room. The pain in my ankle as my friend drove me to the ER was nowhere as bad as the pain in my head. Already, I had visions of needing surgery and being incapacitated for a long period of time. I desperately wanted to believe my injury wasn't serious. When I got to the ER, the triage nurse took one look at my ballooned ankle and told me it was broken. I argued with her and told her the pain wasn't that bad. When someone took my blood pressure and found that it was high, I insisted they measure it again until they got a lower reading. I didn't think of it at the time, but what I was experiencing was information aversion. I knew I had hurt myself, but I didn't want to know how badly. As it turned out, the ankle wasn't broken. It was just a very bad sprain. In the grand scheme of things, an ankle sprain is a trivial problem. It isn't cancer or heart disease or a serious infection. It isn't bankruptcy or like losing a job. But it made me realize that if I could experience information aversion for something so small, it's hardly surprising that people experience much more information aversion when the stakes are higher. People who avoid information rationally know that they would be better off if they fully understood the bad news. You should always be willing to hear information about your finances or your health. But deep in the brain, there are rules that tell us to avoid things that are unpleasant, painful, or scary. Like listeners Jason, Annie, and Nancy, we shut out the news we'd rather not hear. If we want people to pay attention to negative information, we can't assume that they will behave like rational robots. We have to communicate information accurately, but also give people the capacity to process and deal with psychological pain. Fighting the ostrich effect means fighting a myth. Avoiding information doesn't mean you're a fool. It means you're human. Whenever we're presented with harsh realities, avoiding information is just one option in our toolkit. Another strategy we employ when we're in a tough spot? Lying.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
I've said it for longer than 7 years. I have never doped.
Now, when we think of dishonesty, We mostly think about the big stuff.
Where thousands and thousands of people were cheering as that building was coming down.
The answer is I did not send that tweet. My system was hacked. I was pranked. It was a fairly common one. People make fun of my name all the time. When you name Wiener, you kind of get that.
This kind of dishonesty seems so blatant, so wrong.
And you say to yourself, wow, I could have never done this. Like, this is a different kind of a person. That's not me. I can't possibly be like that person.
This is Dan Ariely, researcher and author of the book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. Dan says the truth about dishonesty might surprise you.
What separates honest people from not honest people is not necessarily character, it's opportunity.
One of these opportunities for dishonesty that many of us have but rarely take happens when we sit down for a meal at a restaurant. Dan told me about an unusual question he often asks when he goes out to eat.
I ask the waiter if there's a way to eat and escape without paying. And, you know, sometimes they get strange looks. Sometimes they ask me for my credit card. But they always give me good advice. They say things like, wait for a big party to come, go to the bathroom, there's an alley. I mean, they have suggestions of how to escape without paying. And then I ask them, how often does it happen? And they say, very rarely. And in fact, they say sometimes people leave the restaurant without paying because, you know, we forget whether we paid or not paid. We don't pay attention. And people call back and pay over the phone. So there's a lot of goodness in us. And in fact, the surprising thing for a rational economist would be, why don't people steal more, right? Why don't we take advantage? So we do have some internal moral conscience. We have internalized the values of society, and we don't need anybody around us. We don't need prison sentences. We don't need to be afraid. We make our own judgment of what's right and wrong, and we adhere to those decisions. Now, not perfectly, but to a very large degree.
One of the things that I find interesting about what you're saying is that in some ways, people are often unthinkingly honest. In other words, they're not actually asking themselves, what room do I have to be dishonest? They're actually honest just because it's a rule that they're following. And of course, much of your work has focused on the flip side of that, which is that people are also unthinkingly dishonest. It's not just people who are trying to be dishonest, but people who are making small lapses, small slips, without really thinking about it very clearly.
That's exactly right. One of the guys we talked to, his name is Joe Pep. And Joe was a cyclist. He loved cycling. He loved nothing else in the world but cycling. He was in the Olympic team, the American Olympic team. And then at some point, he went back to school to finish his degree. After a few years, went back to cycling. He goes on this race, but he feels that everybody else is slightly faster. And he's incredibly frustrated, and he cries that night. And one of his friends says, here's a name for a doctor. He goes to see this doctor, white coat and a stethoscope, and the doctor prescribes to him EPO. EPO is a drug that people use for cancer that increases the production of red blood cells. Really good thing if you need energy, right? It means oxygen, basically. He goes to the pharmacy, he gives them the prescription, his insurance company pays for it, he pays the deductible, he takes it to his apartment, he gives himself the first injection, then the next day, the next injection, and so on. Eventually, it's a habit. Then he moves to another team. He finds out that everybody else is doing it. They do it more publicly. Anyway, things continue. Then there's a shortage of EPO. But he has a friend that has connection in China on a Chinese team, and he puts him in touch with a Chinese factory who produces EPO. He imports EPO for himself. Then his friends find out about it and ask him to import for them as well. So he imports for them as well. Eventually, he's a drug dealer. Now, if you just look at Joe Pep and you say, could I ever become a drug dealer who imports EPO? You would say no. But when you look at the first step, you would ask yourself, where exactly would we stop? Imagine yourself in his shoes. Like, it's the first day, you just came back to cycling, you do just as well as you thought you could, everybody is faster. Don't you cry? Of course you do. A friend gives you an address for a physician. Don't you go? Of course you do. The physician gives you a prescription. Don't you go to fill it? Of course you do. You get the prescription, you have all these injections, don't you try once? Of course you do. I mean, when exactly would we stop? And one of the frightening conclusions we have is that what separates honest people from not honest people is not necessarily character, it's opportunity, right? And if we were all in Joe's shoes, maybe we would have all been like this, exactly like this.
One of the things that caught my eye recently, Dan, is that you had a paper that actually explores this very idea from the point of view of science. And this study, remarkably, was actually looking at how the brain operates as people were making these little deceptions.
Yeah, so the brain is really a mechanism for detecting surprising things, right? The brain is basically working on adaptation. You get to a certain level of light. In the beginning, it's surprising, and then you get used to that environment. And this is true across lots of things that the brain does. It turns out that the brain also reacts very strongly to our first act of lying. But then as we keep on lying more and more, the brain kind of stops reacting to it. So we start by being aware of this, maybe being a dishonest act, and we at least are aware of it. But over time, it just goes into the background and we don't pay attention to it.
You've made the case in several books and articles that lying and deception is not usually about, you know, a rational cost-benefit equation where people are balancing the advantages of deception against the risk of getting caught, but about something that you call the fudge factor. What's the fudge factor?
Yeah. So the cost-benefit analysis, by the way, is the kind of the standard framework in economics, right? You say to yourself, how likely am I to get caught? What will happen to me? What can I get away with? How much can I steal? And you basically do a cost-benefit analysis. We find that those things don't really matter. What we find that matters is this intricate balance between wanting to get a bit more selfishly, wanting a bit more right now. I wish I had a bit more money. I wish I had, more prestige, whatever it is. And on the other hand, wanting to look at ourselves in the mirror and feel that we're good, honest people. We can cheat a little bit and still feel good about ourselves. So, for example, if you're on a 65-mile-an-hour road, if you're at 68, you don't think you're speeding. So we have this ability to rationalize our actions and to basically say, yes, you know, under FBI interrogation, I would realize this is not the perfect truth, but it's okay. There's still a reason for it. I can still rationalize. I can still explain what it is, especially when we don't think about it too carefully.
Let's talk a little bit about solutions. You think that one of the things that the IRS should ask taxpayers to do is to fill out a testimonial that says, I declare that everything I say here will be the truth, only the truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God. Why do you think personal testimonials might be useful when people are filling out their tax returns?
Yeah, think about our oral tradition. When people go to court, we swear in the beginning, right? And we swear in the beginning not because we think we know already everything we've said, but we swear in the beginning because we understand as a society, as an institution, that honesty is about the mindset. And you basically say, I swear I'll say the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And you put yourself into that state of being honest from now on. Now, what happened that over the years, lawyers got into things, and instead of using the oral tradition, we sign at the end, right? Every document you sign at the end, not in the beginning. So all of a sudden, it's not about your mindset going in, it's about verification of the fact afterward. But you know what? When you get to the end, lying is over, it's done. Like imagine that you would testify in court and you wouldn't swear in the beginning, you would swear at the end. What? You would say, sorry, let me go back to the third thing I said, let me change my opinion. So what happened is that the legal tradition has kind of taken something that we all intuit quite basically, that honesty is about the mindset, and change it to verification. So that was the initial intuition for this. And we've done quite a few experiments. In one of them, we did it with a big insurance company. This was an insurance company that sends people letters that ask them, how many miles did you drive last year? And if you drove more, you pay a higher premium. You drove less, you pay a lower premium. And people, of course, have the incentive to declare that they drove less because then they would pay less. And they had the regular form, which you fill the numbers in and you sign at the bottom of the form. And we created a new version of the form in which people sign in the beginning. And what we saw was that people drove more by 15% in the condition when they signed up front.
Wow.
By the way, we've replicated it in all kinds of ways, including with the procurement offices within the U.S. government, including with taxes in a country in South America, and including with a traveler insurance in Northern Europe. And in all of those cases, you get people to sign something, they get into kind of a different mental state, they remember honesty, we kind of guard ourselves against being dishonest, and then people feel things in a more honest way. We're not sure perfectly honest, but more honest way. And by the way, we started by looking at the glass half full part of it. This is a tremendously glass half full story, because it says we have the desire to be honest. Something about the education process gets people to want to be honest. We just need to remind people that they want to be honest, and then it works.
When we come back, I'm going to ask Dan about the virtues of deception and self-deception. Our case study, Dan Ariely. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and you're listening to Hidden Brain from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from LifeLock. LifeLock with Norton works to help protect identities and the information on devices from cybercriminals. Learn more at LifeLock.com. From the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing justice and opportunity for people in need. More information at publicwelfare.org. And from the Annenberg Foundation, committed to supporting, educating, and engaging communities in the United States and globally for more than 25 years. Learn more at annenbergfoundation.org.
This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. I'm speaking today with Dan Ariely, researcher and author of the book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. When Dan Ariely was 17 years old, he was at a graduation ceremony. Flares were being sent up to celebrate, and one went off too close to him. 70% of his body was burned, and he spent the next 3 years in a hospital. This story is hard to listen to, but Dan's injuries and the experiences he had with doctors and nurses reveal a lot about human behavior. And they changed the way Dan came to think about deception and self-deception.
It turns out that severe burns that cover all of your body don't go away. I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, I'm more than 30 years later now, and my last surgery was last year. It's a gift that keeps on giving. It's a very, very difficult injury, a lot of pain in the beginning, very hard to recover, and then it keeps on. I mean, the challenges are just ongoing.
So you get to the hospital, you're spending many weeks in the hospital, you're obviously in great pain, various operations and procedures are being performed on you. Did doctors share with you how badly off you were?
No. So first of all, you know, I was in the hospital for almost 3 years in total. In the beginning, you know, of course, all burn patients above 30% are kind of a risk of losing their lives, and nobody told me that. I actually don't think anybody really told me exactly what to expect. But no, I didn't know how long it will be. I didn't know how painful it will be. I didn't understand what burns are. Nobody actually gave me this, you know, really sad view of how the future will evolve from the perspective of the burns.
Now, as somebody who studies dishonesty and deception and who has made a very strong case against deception, you found yourself paradoxically looking back in hindsight, thinking that maybe the doctors did the right thing, that maybe they did the right thing by deceiving you, and maybe you helped in that deception with a certain amount of self-deception as well.
Yeah, and you know, like everybody who gets injured in a deep way, you know, I also contemplated terminating my life. I didn't have much power to do it, but I certainly thought about that. And I think that if I had at the time a more objective view of what the future would hold, I might have tried to do that. So, you know, that's kind of on a a big philosophical kind of meaning of life kind of part, but it also shows up in smaller ways. So I remember one surgery. So this was a surgery to my right hand. And after the surgery, they couldn't put cast on my hand, of course, because it was the skin. You can't put cast on the skin. So instead, what they do is they put these metal nails through the bone to hold the fingers. So I had kind of two nails coming from the side of my thumb and a nail coming in each finger throughout the whole finger. And, you know, kind of basically lots of needles poking out. And by the way, at the end of them, they would put something so I wouldn't poke myself at night if I, by mistake, got my hand too close to my face. And the surgery was done, and 6 weeks later they were going to take off these nails. And I asked the nurse, when are they going to schedule the operating room to take these out? And she said, oh, you know, don't worry about it. We're going to just take it out in the department. And I said, don't you have to put me to sleep for this? And she said, no, it doesn't hurt at all. And it turns out it really hurt. Now, it wasn't probably as bad as putting the nails in, but it was painful, and it took a while to take these, I don't know, 15 nails or so. But think about the 3 weeks that I would have had agony, right, of being afraid. This way, I had the same pain, but without the dread that came up with it. Do I justify lying? It's very tough. But do I recognize that it contributed to my well-being and that I would have had 3 weeks of... You know, I was terrified as it is. You know, when you're a patient, your lack of control and fear is just incredible. You're just lying in bed and other people decide what to do with you, when to do with you. The helplessness is tremendous. And having the fear of people pulling these nails out of me without anesthesia and being painful, I probably would have been very, very difficult to take at the time, adding to that. So I am grateful. I'm grateful. I still think it's a questionable decision, but I am grateful.
I believe that at another time, a nurse introduced you to another burn victim who had survived, and she meant for this to be encouraging, but in some ways it had the opposite effect on you.
Yeah, this was maybe 2 or 3 months after my initial injury. And, you know, because I had no view of what my future would look like, I kind of imagined myself basically going back to regular life. And when they brought this old patient to come, he was supposed to symbol, you know, recovery. He was, I don't know, 15 years after his injury. He was supposed to symbolize somebody who's, you know, made it. And he looked terrible with very severe burns. It was clear he didn't have functions of his hands. He were, you know, everything I have now, right? So they were correct. But at that point, it was a shock to realize that this was the future. And I was hoping for a much more optimistic future than that. Like, my own optimism was much higher than in that reality. So even though they brought that patient to show me how life could turn out well, for me, it was just a shock to the system.
I'm wondering whether this experience helped shape the way you think about self-deception. You know, self-deception has been widely criticized, and obviously it has many consequences, adverse consequences, when we lie to ourselves. But many people have also made the case that if we don't lie to ourselves ever, life becomes often unbearably difficult, and not just when you're, suffering from serious burns, but in all kinds of different ways, we need to deceive ourselves to get through our day. What do you make of that argument?
Look, there's no question that there's some truth to that argument. The question is how much of it. It's true that dishonesty is corrosive and destructive and terrible for society and so on. It's also true that we don't want to eliminate it completely. And the real question is dosage and under what conditions. Sometimes I think about my experience in the hospital, and I don't think I could have taken the physicians telling me exactly the truth. And a couple of years ago, I was asked to help a young guy who was burned, and a relative of his asked me to send this kid an optimistic note about his future. And it was a tremendous torture for me, because on one hand, I didn't think his future was going to be very optimistic. On the other hand, I didn't think it would be right to expose him to the full brutality of the many years that are going to be ahead of him. I debated for about 2 days while crying quite a lot about like what to tell him and what not to tell him, and I've kind of brought myself back to what I wanted to know and not know, and eventually I found some kind of compromise that I was okay with. But it was certainly not the brutal truth straight up.
I want to wrap up with a story that moves us forward by several years, because I feel like this is a wonderful story that reveals so many different aspects about human nature. You were once at an airport confronting a very long line at check-in. Do you remember the story of what happened next?
I remember. It's kind of embarrassing. Do we have to talk about that? Can we talk about something else?
as your own research has shown, Dan, thinking about the stuff that's embarrassing can be very revealing.
It is revealing. Yes. So okay, we'll see where you go with this. You know, I have an injury, but I'm not that injured. Huge line, and I'm there with a friend, and I ask him to go and get me a wheelchair. And, you know, I have a hard time standing for a long time, but I don't need a wheelchair. And he got me a wheelchair, and we checked in very quickly, and we cheated. I mean, I cheated, got quickly in front of the line. So now I'm in this wheelchair waiting for the flight, and I try to go to the bathroom. And, of course, I try to go to the bathroom with a wheelchair, and the bathroom is just not designed for anybody with a wheelchair. And I get really upset. And then it became worse. Because then he takes me with a wheelchair to the plane, and it turns out I'm in seat, I don't know, 37D or something. And now how do I get to the seat? The wheelchair that they gave me was too wide for the seat. We couldn't go through it. So he now carries me on his back to seat 37D, which was fine. But this was a flight from New York to London. And now how do I get to the bathroom? So it's kind of clear to me that I need to stay in character, and I basically don't drink and I don't go to the bathroom. He carries me on his back as we land in London, and then I decide to go and complain to the people from Air India about how they're not treating people with disability. And you know what? I had in me the frustration of somebody who's actually on a wheelchair. I truly went into character. Maybe I should have been an actor. I truly went into character, and I truly felt the humiliation of somebody who actually needs a wheelchair, and the airline is just not doing the right thing. So, you know, this was like unbelievable ability to pretend I was something that I am not, and very quickly get into the character and truly get upset over this. Now, just to say something in my own favor, in my own defense, if I may, Your Honor, I know you're judging me now. I think if I was not injured at all, it would have been tough for me to just make up something completely. But the fact that, you know, I kind of have some difficult standing, I have lots of burns on my legs, not that I deserve, I should need a wheelchair, but it was kind of an easier jump. And I think this is kind of the thing with the slippery slope that we see, and this ability to justify our behavior in all kinds of creative ways. By the way, I should say one more thing. We find that when we look at personality tests of who cheats more, we thought maybe people who take more risks, maybe risk takers cheat more. No. Maybe intelligent people. No. Creative people cheat more. And why do creative people cheat more? Because cheating is all about being able to tell a story about why what we want is actually okay. And sadly, I think I'm creative.
Dan Ariely, I want to thank you for joining me on Hidden Brain today.
It was a pleasure, even though you made me relive a little bit humiliating moments, but I thank you for it.
This episode of Hidden Brain was produced by Maggie Penman, Parth Shah, and edited by Tara Boyle. Our staff includes Jenny Schmidt, Raina Cohen, Thomas Liu, and Laura Querell. For more Hidden Brain, please follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and listen for my stories on your local public radio station. I'm Shankar Vedantam. See you next week.
Support for Hidden Brain comes from the Rockefeller Foundation. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities in education and entrepreneurship to create uncommon solutions and empower people to shape their lives and be more successful. More online at kauffman.org. From C3IoT, powering enterprise digital transformation with artificial intelligence, predictive analytics, and IoT solutions. Learn more at c3iot.ai. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.